These people think that if they're tough enough, smart enough, and mean enough, all this will be there someday. There's no army off this earth that's gonna stop those wagons coming, little as they're wanted.
Dude, a lot has happened since we last recorded. Sheila Jackson Lee died. Biden dropped out. Trump got shot. But we don't have time to talk about any of that.
No. There's a mediocre Western to watch.
We have a mediocre Western to watch. This week, we reviewed Horizon Part 1. Horizon, an American Saga Part 1. The Kevin Costner marriage-ending epic. But we lucked out. We got a guest that is a expert on the American Western, like the genre of the American Western. Professor Brian Huberman of Rice University. This guy really knows his stuff. Alec, I can't speak for you. I had a really fun time talking with him. He's really knowledgeable. I think this interview and discussion is going to be really, really great. I hope everyone at home enjoys what we got for you.
Yeah, I felt guilty talking to him about this shitty movie for an hour and a half. And the movie's fun. It's fine. It's definitely something to talk about. And it got us the excuse to talk to Professor Huberman, which was very, very good. And I hope to do a follow-up, even if we have to do Horizon 2 through 4.
Yeah, we'll see if those even actually get made or released.
Yeah, seriously.
Horizon 2 is in the can. It's looking like it's going to go straight to Netflix.
But we should say, by the way, for those who don't know, Horizon is a series of films, Connor. Yeah. A series of films that Kevin Costner co-wrote, produced, directed, and is planning to re-release at some point as a TV series, I guess. It's like a prestige TV series.
This is a passion project of his that he started writing in the 80s. And he basically, this is what when he finished writing the script, I assure you, he thought, this is my lonesome dove.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's going to be 4 3-hour movies that when they're all released, they are going to be re-edited and repackaged as a television series that Kevin Costner hopes to shop around to various streaming services, and not just to find a home for it. It's just like, I'll give it to Netflix for a year, and I'll get some money off of Amazon. He really thinks everyone's going to give me $100 million
Mad Men or whatever.
Yeah.
You know what? It could be, right? Like, the thing he's trying to do, he's basically trying to remake How the West Was Won,
mm-hmm.
but for, like, I don't know, for like the 21st century with Costner vision. So I imagine, like, there was so much. Costner has said that, like, How the West Was Won is like what inspired him to get into Westerns, basically. It was like his first Western. So I imagine it's going to be about as disjointed as that movie is, which, like, takes place over the course of like 100 years, you know?
Yeah. What's that guy's name? Plots. James Michener?
I don't know.
He wrote Hawaii. He wrote Texas.
Oh, I'm thinking of Oklahoma. Never mind. Got that.
Okay. All right. No problem.
You're not taking the full measure of this, Mary. I know the man I met was on his way to kill everyone in that house. He might as well have been walking up to get the mail for all that bothered him.
Let's just go ahead and get right to the conversation with Professor Huberman, and hope y'all enjoy.
You know, the reason that we're here, I think specifically, is this new Costner film, Horizon, right? I mean, that's what's brought us to the table, as it were. So I did make the effort of going. I don't go to the movies that often anymore. I'm not sure why, because they're so comfortable, these movie houses now. I mean, it's such a far cry from the old days. But it's a strange film, I think, or the conception, because it's not a film, is it? It's a series of, is it 6 parts? Are there 6 parts?
4 parts, and they're each going to be 3 hours long, and then eventually re-edited into a television miniseries.
It's clearly a TV kind of designed piece, so it's odd to encounter it in a movie house setting. at my clinic, one of the operatives there, turned out she had been to see Horizon. Now, she's not a Western genre fanatic. She's just a regular person, a popcorn-buying person, I would categorize her as. And she clearly had trouble with that film in the sense that I think she had a hard time following what was going on. You know, because we were going to have this chat, when I sat down to watch the film, you know, I was on guard. I thought, well, I better pay attention because I'm going to have to say something about it. And I really had to make an effort, I must admit, to keep up with it. Or unless maybe I'm just old and miserable now. And it's...
No, I don't think so. I mean, Connor and I were talking in kind of pre-production after I'd seen it. And it's difficult to divine what Costner's aim is, right? Yeah. What as a work itself, right? So, what story are we trying to tell here?
I don't mean, it sounds as if I'm criticizing the film, you know, the old boring thing. It's not conforming to this. This is what Heaven's Gate got hit with long ago, a film that I favor very highly in the genre. That film was eviscerated by the New York critics and others in 1980 or 81 when it came out. And thanks to the writings of Robin Wood in his book, From Vietnam to Reagan, he really salvaged that film for me, because Wood's argument was that the reason that Heaven's Gate was attacked was because its strategy of storytelling did not conform to the standards, the canons, as it were, of storytelling. Like, you know, Heaven's Gate is on one level is a love triangle. The movie is almost 4 hours long. And one of the elements of the love triangle apparently do not show up until 2 hours into the film. 2 hours into the film.
That's wild.
If you compare Heaven's Gate to Shane, and they're both about the Johnson County War, so it's a fair comparison, I think. In Shane, in the opening scene, the first 15 minutes of the film, the opening sequence, rather, all the elements, narrative elements you need to know to encounter the film are presented to you. So you have the full deck of cards, as it were, in your hands, you know, which is the way most conventional Sid Field-type narratives conform to. And Heaven's Gate violated that and paid the price.
Well, thankfully, I think Horizon's going to be bought for an astronomical sum.
Yeah, Netflix just made an offer. Amazon Prime made an offer that Kevin Costner rejected. So Netflix just made an offer, and we'll see how that turns out.
See. Well, I'm
I
sure
don't know about the critics, but Kevin Costner is at least quite likely to get his pound of flesh for his $100 million investment.
I think it's an interest. What I'm getting at, going sort of round the barn slowly, is that I do think it's an interesting film. But I can see that some people... Well, I mean, we read the reports. You know, the turnout to see it at the box office was not great. And part two that was supposed to come out has been delayed. So, you know, obviously, audiences are not responding to it. And I say... bullshit. So what? You know,
I mean, one of the problems is I hadn't even heard about the thing until Connor told me, and I said, "Wow, Costner." I mean, I'm aware of Costner because of Yellowstone, and personal ideology is interesting to me because it seems oddly ahistoric and very self-serving. But you know, that's my criticism of him. So I was interested in seeing it, and I don't know of anyone in my life who would even mention the film. No one was aware.
I must admit, I hadn't. I mean, I just haven't been, you know, I don't read Variety or God knows what, you know. I mean, I rely on others like you guys to kind of.
I
wouldn't have gone to the film to see the film.
I do read Variety. I read the trades. And when I heard that Kevin Costner ruined his marriage after pouring in over $50 million into this like four movie epic, I got excited because I do. I really like the Avatar movies because James Cameron's like, I have seven of these planned. Like, I love an ambitious director taking big swings. And I knew that's what I was going to get, whether or not I liked it. And I walked out of the movie. I saw it in theaters the first time. And I think the movie really lends itself to the fact that, like, you can't pull out your phone and distract yourself when you're in the theater. When I watched it a second time at home, it was a little easier for me to look at Instagram and see like what's going on.
But James Cameron, he is not. I mean, Avatar came out. It's highly polished. It still holds up today. It's for everything else that you'd say about a, you know, a weak allegory about, I guess, American imperialism. I don't know. I don't know what that film is supposed to be. But
well, yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen that. But let's not stray too far from Horizon. So I kind of led off with the criticism that the popcorn eater might be puzzled by it and distressed. And, you know, if it winds up on TV, well, then people just watch anything. You know, it becomes wallpaper in the background, grinding on and on. None of that is interesting to me. I'm not in this for the business. The fact that it cost $100 million, I think I read somewhere, you know, that figure means nothing to me. I kind of... no way of relating to $100 million. I'm a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker, and you know, I made films for nothing, literally nothing. The cost of an airplane ticket every now and again, something like that. And that's not the way I look at these films, or you know, I judge them on. I suppose really more on, are they trying to do something interesting? Are they contributing to the great plan, as it were, or are they just a drug, a distraction, as you know many films are? In the case of Horizon, I don't see that. I do think that he's after something. Whether how well he's done it, I can't tell, and we won't know until we've seen the whole thing. We have to give him that.
Yeah,
and, sure. But the title itself is interesting. Horizon. In the film, that refers to it's a pamphlet advertising a settlement program. Go west, young man. And
a tract of land, particularly in southwestern Arizona, right, is where everybody seems to be ending up in the exactly. San Pedro Valley.
And they're all dying there. They're all dying there. They're all failing.
Everybody that's gotten there so far.
Right. Well, this, you see, I think refers to this is where the film has a historical vibration. That I find interesting. This kind of a way in which American corporations in the late 19th century via the railroad lied to settlers to encourage them to invest in the West and help make the railroads, you know, pay off and so on. And what they did was provide tracts of land that weren't large enough or viable enough for agriculture. Because when you cross the 100 meridian heading west, that's a north-south dividing line, the amounts of rainfall begin to decrease dramatically. Now, the American corporate souls and business tycoons of the day were all Easterners, and their understandings of agriculture were kind of shaped by Eastern environments, more rainfall. They applied the same standards to the West. So you have just terrible failures or terrible disasters on a human level, not to Indian attacks, as this film kind of presents it, but to the very corrupt plans that the corporate leaders set up. And their justification for it, their excuse was rain follows the plow. That line is actually said in the film. And that comes from a poem by some guy called Wilbur. I forget. The book you need to look at for this is by an American historian, Richard White. The title of the book is It's Not Your Misfortune and None of My Own. It's not your, which is
quite funny.
A line from a cowboy song. Richard White's a really interesting American historian who's, in terms of American frontier history, I think you could put him in the category of the new frontier historians. He's now at Stanford. He's a serious character. American frontier history has been in the hands of not interesting writers for a long time, I think. People who still adhere to the old notions, the old myth of progress, whose roots go back to Frederick Jackson Turner and the significance of the frontier in American history, this famous paper written in 1893. So Richard White's book, rather than following the old ideas of the myth of progress, is pointing to new studies on the frontier, which focus on labor and environment. Labor and environment. Those elements were never studied it tends to be the frontier, and quickly we're absorbed into a kind of a sentimental environment inhabited by Natty Bumpo and Chingachgook and so on, which is a bit like joining Trump's MAGA philosophy of Make America Great Again, this sort of dreadful vacuum cleaner sucking us back into some impossible past which never existed. You know?
America's memory is fairly short, if it exists at all.
It has no memory. That's sadly, you know, the tragedy of all fascist states. You know, that now we need to read George Orwell, I suppose. But anyway, Richard White's book, there's hope there, and that we need to focus on the environment instead of just simply exploiting the frontier and its resources, as de Tocqueville observed, that, you know, our job now is to conserve and defend them. And I think that somewhere in whoever wrote Horizon, I'm sure they were reading Richard White. I cannot help
but. So it's co-written by Kevin Costner, and a man whose only other writing credit is a documentary series about the national parks. So it's quite in that vein. So I like to open the conversation up. So what I had hoped to watch was, I had this imagining of Kevin Costner potentially as this obsessive visionary, where the details of every part of the story were going to be meticulously researched, and the dress and the manner of speech and the firearms, perhaps, and the dates were all going to be entirely historical. And that's not what you get, right? Unfortunately, right? There's a number of complaints I have about the historicism of the film. Maybe that's boring, but I'll enumerate them, right? First and foremost, I'm kind of a firearms guy in another life. Got a lot of problems with firearms in this film. Purportedly, right, the film shows somebody etching a date literally into the side of a boulder, right, upon arrival in this settlement in Arizona, and it says 1863. So the presumption, we're never corrected, so the presumption is it's 1863. Brass cartridge firearms are ubiquitous in this basically outland by a lot of people who are essentially settlers. They do exist at the time. They're in extremely small number, mostly being used in the Civil War. And these people would not have afforded them. We're talking about muzzle loaders, percussion cap, muzzle loading firearms. It's a small thing, but it's noticeable. The Civil War is mentioned in maybe two or three lines. And if we're to believe the date, it's ongoing. The lack of open talk, especially in the Southwest, is entirely noticeable. I mean, the Santa Fe Trail, for that particular vignette, that subplot, they're going through Kansas, right? Which is just experience. Not only is it tremendously settled, it's not desert all the way through. They're passing farms all the way through Kansas, essentially. We don't see that. And it was a bitter place following the Bleeding Kansas campaign, the Civil War battles that existed, both antebellum and during the war, and would have been an enormous and fascinating focal point of American history that's not talked about. And then third, really striking, is the decided lack of religiosity of these Americans. Americans of the time, if you want to be historical, maybe Kevin Costner's not interested in that, are deeply religious. If you read Civil War letters, right, which, you know, obsessives about the Civil War read, there is no possible way a settlement in the outland of Southwest Arizona that the biggest building in town is a dance hall. That's ridiculous, right? It's the church every single time, right? I was actually quite pleased in the opening scene with the, I don't know what he is, a preacher. There's a settler that passes. He finds these dead men. And in good Christian fashion, he takes out his shovel and digs them graves and then reads from the book out loud, you know, for effect possibly. And I thought, wow, a representation of mid-19th century American religiosity. Fantastic. And it's the last time you'll hear about the Bible in the entire rest of the film.
Well, one of your questions to me was, how do these films, you know, deal with the times that they're set in, and how do they reflect the times they were made in? And I think you're going down an avenue that leads nowhere, ever, in all Westerns. I think
no railroads, too. Yeah,
it's a no-win situation. These films are not histories. They're dramas. And they don't care about history. You know, the old jokes about John Ford. He'd send this guy off to research the cavalry when he was getting ready to do one of those cavalry movies, the guy came back with all this stuff, and he reportedly said, "No, can now throw that out, and we're going to make the film." And, you know, he fucked up the uniforms, had people wearing things incorrectly, because he liked that, to throw things off balance in all kinds of ways, in all kinds of ways. I mean, I looked at the, I was thinking about the historical veracity. I mean, it's not important to me, but I do always think about it as best I can. I'm not a great firearms guy like you, but I noticed that everyone's hair is way too long. You know, at least judging from the photograph, there are many photos from the late 19th century frontier, and everyone looks like Sam Elliott, who seems to have the best haircut for a cowboy.
Hair too long, beards too short. The settler photographs, they had enormous beards. Many, many men would have these foot-long beards.
That's right. Probably, you know, in the Civil War, they're all wearing big beards. In fact, I was hearing that. The last presidents to have facial hair were in the 1880s. Somebody was talking, because Vance, the vice president of Trump, has a beard. The media has nothing better to talk about than all the scalp hunters in the that gang of kind of deplorables, their hair and, you know, it's we're back to the 1960s again, when all the characters had reflecting a fashion of the 1960s. This is very hard to escape. Films are made in a moment in time. All artworks are. Whether they're consciously reflecting that their time they're made in, they are reflecting that time. That's something I just don't think can be avoided.
I wanted to point out that Alec and I had discussed previously that this movie does feel like a reflection of our current time right now, and that it seems to be a resistance to what has been colloquially referred to as wokeness. Because I was talking about the movie Power of the Dog, and how Sam Elliott's reaction to that, where he gave an interview where he essentially said there were no gay people in the wild.
He really had to step back from that, right?
Yeah. And I think Westerns in recent years have become more subversive and challenging historiosity and challenging that propaganda of the American frontiersman. And this movie seems like, let's go back to how Westerns used to be. Let's have morality very clearly defined. You know who's good. You know who's bad. There's no room for discussion on someone's moral character. This feels like if you grew up watching Westerns, this is for you.
I see. You could be right. You could be right. It's to me, and I've only seen part one, of course. To me, and another thing I find interesting about it is there seem to be very self-conscious references to the history of the genre, not American history, but the history of the film genre. The opening sequence of the film is dominated by a defense of a cabin, a battle for a cabin, which seems to be a remake of Griffith's 1914 movie, The Battle of Elderbrush Gulch, which is a very, very famous silent movie. It's a white cabin filled with white people and white women who are hiding in a container in the cabin, not unlike they do in this trench in the film. And then later on in the film, there's a wagon train, which seems to be referencing the first great American Western epic, James Cruise's Covered Wagon, made in 1923. And if you recall, there is this extraordinary natural feature of cliffs that the wagon train is moving along underneath. And that's absolute remake from the 1923 movie. It's almost like they were made in the same location.
A lot of things get filmed in the Valley of the Gods. I mean, certain spires look, when you see them in a film, you know that it's this one place because it's so...
Exactly. But I'm just saying that in this film, and this is just part one, I see two clear references to founding statements in the story of the Western. And I wonder if the episodes go on, whether, you know, are we going to see the Searchers later on and Stagecoach, you know, in funny kind of ways? Is that what's going to happen? That would conform, in a sense, to your point about this being a kind of a let's get back to the innocent Westerns, the uncomplicated Westerns. The other thing I want to say is at the end of the episode, the end of the 3 hours, we finally encounter in all their glory the horrid scalp hunter gang that we've kind of been teased with along the way. But now the whole bunch are there, led by a great actor, Jeff Fahey, who I think is the most underrated, underused guy. 30 years before, he was in the Clanton gang in Wyatt Earp for Kevin Costner. So they're obviously old buddies. But prior to that, he was with Clint Eastwood in a most underrated film, White Hunter, Black Heart. Do you remember that?
I have not seen that one.
White Hunter, it's a great film where Clint Eastwood plays John Huston, the filmmaker, in the process of getting ready to make The African Queen. And it's based on Peter Viertel's book about it. And Jeff Fahey plays Peter Viertel, who is a scriptwriter who goes along with Huston on this mad adventure. Anyway, Jeff Fahey shows himself to be, you know, he has a really interesting part to play in that film. He's not covered in facial hair, so you can actually see him. And, you know, he gets to sort of be his full self. And it's a shame. I've never seen him in a decent role since. And so here he is again with the hair all over him and, you know, a bit of a caricature rather than a full-born character, which is a shame. But anyway, what I'm getting at is at the end of the piece, we get to meet the full gang. And to me, this is a reference to a really interesting Western element, which is Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian.
Yeah, we made the Judge Holden comparison a few times talking about that, Lee. Okay.
Well, now this is something quite different. This is quite different. There's nothing kind of warm or fuzzy about that reference, because in Cormac McCarthy's vision, our heroes are bloody killers who literally kind of wander the wilderness. Any sense of progress or advancement, which so many Westerns, certainly of the older years, are fired by, so that the violence has meaning because civilization will be the product of it. All of that is wiped away in Cormac McCarthy's bloody vision. And we're now adrift in a sea of blood, adrift in a sea of blood. And that is a vision of America now in our interior. Now, that's a vision, a subversive vision that counters the warm, fuzzy, let's go back to the simple Western. You can have both, but they're both there. When I saw the scalp hunters, that was my reaction to it. And it depends, you know, a film like this is almost by design, not finely crafted together as a smooth narrative that, like your baby bird, you absorb. You have to work with this narrative. You have to work with it and you have to bring stuff to it. And I bring a lifetime of working and playing and dreaming about the Western genre. You know, I've read many of the books and I've seen many of the films. And I think that's who you have to be to really engage with this film. I mean, if you don't have that, well, you can get something out of it. Of course you can. But if you're going to get the full measure, well, then you have to step up to the plate with it. We have to get together after more of the parts have come out to see, you know, whether this is true. I'm just guessing.
The tone of the scalping plot is so fantastically at odds tonally with that of the survivors of the Horizon settlement, whatever you want, the mother and her daughter, you know, who have a nice time bonding with the, you know, various soldiers at the little fort. When you're thrust back into the McCarthy vision, even after watching the film, I had thought, you know, did anybody point out perhaps to Mr. Costner that this is, it's not just that it's a competing vision. I think one actually distracts from the other. The Hallmark movie stuff, I find.
Yeah, that makes it really a TV series because you're just tonally shifting from goofy scene where people are trying to carry a bed secretly out of their house to people just dying in the American frontier.
Critically, our like love story, our Little House on the Prairie kiss scene occurs, I think, directly following the scene where an Indian village is slaughtered and people are summarily scalped, and even right critically, one of the I believe the Mexican desperado as part of the group is also killed and presumably scalped. Yes, which is like is a direct reference to McCarthy.
Right. I mean, you're right. We have these different elements that clearly exist in the piece. Do they integrate? They don't seem to kind of want to integrate. The question now is, well, do we celebrate this as a kind of a unique kind of narrative, a complex narrative? Or do we jump to the conclusion that the New York critics made about Heaven's Gate and say, this guy doesn't know how to tell a story? You know, what is a story? You know, that's we're in a very kind of interesting time now. What with the TV series and, you know, the whole notion of a narrative is kind of went up in the air with these multi-part kind of things. And it's given us, you know, the great possibilities now where we can now juggle all kinds of things in the air, which we never could before. This is not John Ford's world. This is not his kind of Western, not his kind of story. But he's dead, and that time is dead. You know, we live in a complex time. You know, we live in a nation where half the country is at the other half's throats. It's like civil war, the way I hear about it taught. Civil war kind of like teeters on the brim. It's not a time for the old stories. Then you're just talking about movies as drugs, a nostalgic distraction, and I'm not into it. My, you know, when I teach the Western, you know, in my opening remarks, I tell them that, you know, for a lot of people, the Western is just that, a nostalgic time out of war. But if that were the case, if I believed that, we would not be meeting tonight. I wouldn't teach the course. The power for me in the Western, the thing that I find interesting about them, is their subversive quality. Look at High Noon, for fuck's sake. Look what that was doing. I mean, it took on the nation. You know, it challenged the miserable autocracy of the McCarthy state, not Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah.
But that other McCarthy, that kind of right-wing misery that, you know, is threatening us once again. That was a film that was taking a stand. I mean, it was kind of openly about that stuff. But in the Italian Westerns, which was a huge turning point in the 1960s, I remember that. And in 1967, I was in a movie house in London's West End. I'd been to see a film. I think it was In the Heat of the Night. That was a hot film at that moment, 1967. And I watched that. And when the film ended, the movie house manager announced that they had a sneak preview of a new film that we could stay and watch for free if we wanted. And it was A Fistful of Dollars.
Ooh.
Which, wow. You know, if you recall, was made in 64 or 65, but didn't make it to the civilized world until 67. With apologies to Italy.
None needed.
And so I sat there unprepared, and on came Fistful of Dollars. And that film had only been on about 5 seconds when I realized that I would never be the same again, that this was something kind of unique and special. And of course it was. And I am a Leone fan. I know Tarantino, you know, chooses the other guys. And they're all interesting. Of course they are. But, I mean, Leone has just made a stronger impact, I think, and lasts longer. But in Leone's films and the others, first of all, we're reminded where the frontier myth comes from. It comes from the old world. I mean, John Ford was asked about the Italian Westerns just prior to his death. And he feigned kind of shock. Here's this goddamn Irishman, you know, this professional Irishman. They're so full of bullshit, all of these characters. The initial thing was it was like plagiarism or kind of a great crime that a non-American should be. But the American frontier myth was kind of born in the old world. And in particular, when I teach the Italian Westerns, I go back to a poem from the Middle Ages, a European poem called The Land of Cocaine. And The Land of Cocaine is a poem about social utopia. You know, Europe in the Middle Ages with a feudal system. So, of course, people, there's no upward mobility in a feudal system. If you're a serf or a peasant, you're born into a low strata and that's where you remain. And out of frustration of being stuck in this kind of lowly position, it's not hard to kind of see how a culture of resistance is likely to kind of be born. And The Land of Cocaine was a poem that expressed this sort of idea of resistance or reaction against this stultifying kind of feudal order. And in the poem, it speaks to a land to the west. And remember, this is prior to the discovery of the New World. In this land to the west will be, well, basically a social utopia where we're freed from overlords, we're freed from all the pressures of the church, of the nobility, and so on. And there's free and equal distribution of all goods, a social utopia. And I think for filmmakers like Leone, the myth of the United States very much kind of involves that idea. The myth as presented by Hollywood cinema, in particular the Western. He is in love with the Hollywood Western. The hope of the Hollywood Western is for a great egalitarian society, a democratic society born of nature. It just is. It just is. And that society, he feels, that dream was betrayed by capitalism. Because, of course, Leone is a, you know, a Marxist intellectual in Italy. The capitalist system is a betrayal of all things to him. But what's interesting about his films is this duality, because on the one hand, he's his lover. He loves the Western. I mean, when you watch a few minutes of a Leone film, have you ever heard spurs clink on a wooden boardwalk as you have in his film? Have you ever heard the chambering of a shell in a rifle, the sound effects of that, as clearly and as wonderful? It's a whole universe that's going on. And in terms of clothing, of course, soundtrack, thanks to Morricone, he totally revitalized the genre. Because it's not that he turned it into spaceships or did anything kind of extravagant like that. He just took a step to the left. And we experienced horses and riders and all the equipage and so forth from a slightly different angle. And it was all alive and all reborn for us again. So in that sense, it was, we could all love his films because of that love. But if we could see into them, Father, Fistful of Dollars for a few dollars more, stories of bounty hunters working for money, it's an attack on the what happened to America. You know, the capitalist overlay kind of destroyed the dream. I think Once Upon a Time in the West is the height of that vision.
Isn't that your favorite Western, Alec? Once Upon a Time in the West?
It's my favorite. I mean, you talking about Leone and the auditory storytelling, I'd say, that the first bar scene, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. The first bar scene where it's silent and there's the stagecoach off camera, there's the stagecoach fight, and then the dust comes in the door, and then the slow walking of boots all the way until the doors open. I mean, I remember the first time I saw it, I was blown away. I said, this is nothing like John Wayne, you know?
Exactly. No, it's a rebirth, Yeah, absolutely. At the same time, a real challenge to the American story, if you have the eyes to see it. You see, in that period, the American filmmakers, particularly in the wake of the Vietnam War and the My Lai massacre, the news of that, were eviscerating the genre. Did you ever see Soldier Blue?
I've not, no.
Soldier Blue is a captive narrative of sorts, and the climax is the massacre at Sand Creek in Colorado in 1864, I believe. A terrible massacre. And, you know, because we had the news of My Lai that American soldiers did these terrible atrocities, these filmmakers to eviscerate the American story. They just applied that to this frontier story. And we just see, you know, the terrible kind of bloody things that, you know, body parts are taken. You know, they hacked off, you know, breasts, genitals, like a bunch of serial killers went to Denver and had a parade. And they rode down the high street in Denver waving the body parts. Can you believe this? Anyway, the film Soldier Blue presented that tale. And when you came out of that movie, which I did, again in London, I was living in England at that time, you just wanted to open your veins after that. It was like, it was just, you know, you just felt like hopeless. There's nothing you can do, which is not the case with the Leone films, you see. And that's why they've lost it, because he's a lover and a hater, a lover and a hater. And he was able to fold his critique of American history and capitalism into these great films, which are these kind of lovely celebrations of the myth, of the great myth. The myth of America is without a doubt, you know, the great democracy, which is about to fail us. It's about to disappear. Do you realize that?
Oh, only too well.
Yeah, you can talk about that.
You may not believe that. I don't know. A lot of people don't believe it. But that's what I see. I see that myth going down the toilet.
I'm an enormous propagator of that idea. I think more people need to come to grips with where we are structurally.
In Leone's work, even though he critiques mercilessly the capitalist story, the American myth is... that hope of what should have been or might, could still be, you know, let's be positive.
So I'd like to ask exactly right on time. So the myth, I mean, I look at Western as essentially a blank canvas. It's why it's so compelling. You can tell virtually any story because, as you suggested earlier, right, the history doesn't really matter, right? It's a place where things can be complicated in ways that an author, a writer, or director would like, and in some ways it can be simplified, all the way to a pure anarchist vision, all the way to a small society, right, a utopian society. So this myth, I mean, Kevin Costner's trying to convey something about an American vision of the past, potentially of the future that he sees. What do you see? What's in this vision that that Costner's trying to convey? What is this myth?
Well, first of all, he loves the myth of the West, doesn't he? He's quite clearly, he's made Dances with Wolves. He was in Silverado, a film I don't care for. Wyatt Earp, Yellowstone, for Christ's sake. And maybe others that, I don't pretend to be a big fan of Costner. I find him a little bit solemn for my taste. But there's no doubting his commitment. What is the myth? I suppose he's, like I said, it's a little unfair to ask me until I've kind of seen the whole package. But I would say that his commitment is to that myth, but in all its faces. Like I said, I see Battle of Elderbrush Gulch. I see Covered Wagon. These are kind of founding statements of the Western. I also see Cormac McCarthy's bloody vision of the end of that myth and a society without myth that is just adrift in a sea of blood. I see all these elements in there. And at the moment, I think he's just kind of laying out the elements. And we have to wait and see what he does with that.
I've definitely given a lot of thought to, like, what is the myth that Costner is trying to push for and what we're going to see by the end of it. And I there are two things that really, like, solidify my view on this. One is, I think with all these different stories seemingly heading towards Horizon, the settlement, I think Horizon is going to represent this idea of the American dream that people from all backgrounds can come together over one shared vision of what America should be. And I think we're going to really challenge that by, like, the fourth one with the Chinese family that only shows up at the very end of this first one. I am curious to see if racism will play a part at all in these movies beyond just like the trappers versus the Native Americans. I also think about the British character and his wife that is on the Santa Fe Trail vignette. And I think based on his interactions with Luke Wilson, he's going to learn what it is to be an American by getting up and working. You know, Luke Wilson kicks him because he's not working. He's not helping you. And
no, that's right. I forgot that. Right.
Yeah. I think by the end of his narrative, he'll be like, I'm an American. I work for a living. And that's going to be like Kevin Costner's message is that America is a place for anyone to come and just be.
But that's appalling. That kind of old meritocracy kind of.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's a bit simplistic. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff going on in these films. As you talk, I'm kind of reminded of things that I forgot about. You know, it's hard in one viewing to absorb all these different things. So, you know, I've just shared what stood out to me. As I hear that stuff, you know.
I'm not saying I agree with Costner. I just think that's the world that he lives in and the world that he thinks is good.
You see, this idea, first of all, let me comment on something you said about the Horizon Project. If I understood you, you said that this may be something where people are going to kind of connect with and make happen. That can't be the case. It can't be. That failed. Historically, that failed. That rain follows the plow bullshit. It didn't happen.
Right.
It didn't happen. That was some kind of feigned kind of that religiosity that was employed by kind of unscrupulous characters to prey on the weaknesses of those pioneer types. That by if they sweated out there, their sweat would provoke rain. Literally, that's what they were told. And that's what, sadly, many of them believed. And it failed. It failed. And the final failure of it was the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. It's over. That vision never happened. That myth is a lie, right, of a great agricultural yeoman farmer type environment in the West. Didn't happen. Didn't. And if Costner presents that and says, well, then he did not read Richard White's book. And I'll take it back. So there.
I think he will present. I would think he will present that. I mean, the through line, the ideological through line that I see here is that the settlement of the West is inevitable. And Costner, as an individual, although capitalist and in our cultural fashion, right, a right wing, an individualist, right. I think, by the way, his the character that he portrays in Yellowstone, which I've talked about on another episode, I think that is actually a fair representation of Costner's beliefs about the United States. I think he's basically said as much in some interviews.
That's not Taylor Sheridan's view?
It is, but actors and leading men have a way of let's say, embodying or ascribing themselves to these characters.
He left Yellowstone, but somewhere I read that he left Yellowstone in order to do something and get it right. I'm going to do it on my own and pay the cost, take the, you know, but I'm going to get it right this time. And now here we are looking at it just looks like another goddamn Western, really.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's messier. And because it's stretched out over hours and hours and hours, but it's another Western. You know, the same guys are in it, and we have the same incorrect costumes and haircuts, and you say guns, and you know, and lack of respect for God. So again, it reflects our moment.
Yes.
Yeah, not the 1870s or 60s or whatever.
I think Costner is deeply troubled by the history of the United States in a way that is very, I mean, I'd say of this moment, the liberal kind of rewriting of American history on lines of attempts to be humane to, you know, to the American Indian, perhaps. None of this is new, right? In fact, Dances with Wolves, we're doing this for 40 years now. But as part of a continued project.
Better in Dances with Wolves.
So. Much better. It's much better.
You know, they actually were characters.
Yeah.
You know, that guy, the Indian leader, does it. They just sit around and talk. They're totally static, all those Indian scenes. They just said, because we're so reverential to them, you know, we can't even move the fucking camera, you know, when we're in their presence. And that Indian leader I saw in Hell or High Water, he plays the Comanche, yes, at the casino. And again, he was great. in the casino scene there. I mean, you know, there was some grit to it. Some, he had some teeth.
Hell or High Water, a wonderful modern Western. I'm not crazy about the ending, but
I constantly watch that film. It's I don't know why. That's a great film. Anyway, yeah, the Indians are, again, you know, we're just so fucking respectful to them. You know, what is he talking about? We killed them all.
Yes, yes.
You can't now kind of pretend that we're being respectful to them and not address that, you know, and he's not addressing it. I noticed at one point in the Indian section of the film, there's a scene where a single Indian is attacked and I think killed by other Indians. It sort of caught me off guard a bit. I don't know who he was, but it's interesting to me because that attack on the Indian is based on a painting by Frederick Remington. It's a painting called Ridden Down, and it depicts a lone Indian standing by his horse, singing his death song. And in the background, you see a whole group of Indians on horseback coming to kill him. You have to realize at the end of the 19th century, the last stand myth becomes almost fetishized in Anglo-Saxon cultures because it's a time of empire building. And we have a lot of people like Custer and those guys at Isandlwana, you know, finding themselves overextended in the in enemy country, dark-skinned people country, being caught out and overrun and massacred, killed. And that produced a whole series of great paintings, oil paintings, and then later on great movies have celebrated this last stand idea. And the last stand myth is really an ultra right-wing vehicle to celebrate the sacrifice of it's sort of like an expression of Kipling's White Man's Burden poem, where the white man is seen as sacrificing himself for the dark-skinned people by going out into those areas to save them from darkness. It's that kind of idea. So these disasters that could be politically threatening to leadership at the time found a way of cashing in on the loss of their military units by celebrating them as these great sacrifices. So if you go to the British Army Museum in London, you can see the Great Defense, the Last Stand of Isandlwana. It's huge, huge painting. You know, if you go to the Governor's Mansion in Texas, you can see the Fall of the Alamo. This huge painting, the Custer painting. Anyway, back to Ridden Down. At the end of the 19th century, the American Indians that had posed such a threat to American progress and advancement were really done. They were all on reservations about the time that Remington began his career as an artist. He started his work in 1886. He was sent west to do illustrations for the Geronimo campaign. But at that time, he never got off the train. He just stayed on there, and his work is not very interesting. But later on, he spent his summers, he was an Easterner who spent his summers in the West on horseback with various Western units. But after the fact, you know, the Indians were now on reservations. They were no longer a threat. So they were sentimentalized as much in the way that Costner, and he's not the only filmmaker that does that, don't get me wrong, but that's what we have here. They're being sentimentalized because they're no longer a threat to us. And so, now, we sentiment for different reasons. Costner is trying to be a good human being, I guess. Frederick Remington is sentimentalizing them because if we build up this image of the American Indian as this great warrior figure, then we are being built up because we were the great warriors who defeated them. So anyway, it's almost as if the film is footnoted to me. I kind of see the footnotes of what, and you know, all films are like that. You know, this is not an attack on the film. This is how we work, you know, as a filmmaker, as a lover of the Western, as I'm sure he is. He embraces all this stuff. They look at the book paintings of Frederick Remington, like all filmmakers do, and Charles Russell, kind of to get kind of visual ideas. And so obviously that idea came into the film that way. Now, the question is, has he digested this stuff? Has he made it his own? Or are they just these isolated references? Is it a scrapbook or is it a film? And I don't know yet.
Quite so. I mean, in works like this, if you're going to try to make an epic, I would prefer some level of ideological cohesion or cohesion of vision, even if it's not one that I politically agree with. I mean, a good fascist epic is much better than, as you say, a scrapbook, a smattering of vignettes, you know, that are
Triumph for the Will.
Oh, well, yeah, say what you will, but I mean, it's a vision.
Your propaganda theme. We haven't talked about that.
It's compelling at the very least. And I would say that this is a propaganda of a sort. Right. But as you say, I say it's we'll see what it ends up being. Right. What this ends up being on final edit. But for now, it seems half digested.
Well, you see, as propaganda, I don't think it can work very well. Propaganda would seem to me not exactly my area, but it would seem to me to be more focused. But on the other hand, I do remember reading something by Eisenstein, the great Russian filmmaker, who said that propaganda was a good thing. I mean, that was his position because he felt his take on propaganda was that it was love. When you kind of really love something, well, that you put it out like that. So this is it. This is what I love. You should love it too. This is wonderful. You know, we tend to think of propaganda as something trying to put something nasty across. But what if it's something lovely? And it could be that it is. You know, Costner's view of the Western is all embracing. He loves it all.
Yeah.
Warts and all the stuff, you know, and he doesn't care if it's not kind of neatly put together. You know, I remember him defending long films once years ago, because I guess his films have tended to be longer than most.
Yeah.
And he just said, you know, I like long films, and I have to agree with them as a filmmaker. You know, I'm currently working on a documentary which is called Geronimo. It's 7 hours long. It's 7 one-hour pieces. And I'm sure I will be attacked for it being rambling and without shape at times and so on. So I'm hardly going to attack Kevin Costner for that. I like long films too, and I don't mind getting lost in them. I really don't.
I agree. I love a long movie.
Kind of film experience. You know, the tight narrative, you know, that there's a place for that. That's good too. Hell or High Water is a tight narrative. I enjoy that film.
Yeah.
Sicario.
We love Sicario here. We love Sicario. Yeah,
I like, you know, that's another film that I find that I can watch again and again. I'm not sure why, but it's something. I think the journey into Juarez to pick up that guy, it's just fantastically done. It's a great piece of cinema.
The cartel accountant or whoever he is, it really doesn't matter who he is, which is...
No, it's just the sweep. It's so beautifully done. Anyway, those are the tight narratives, and of course, they're great. But Horizon is not a tight narrative. and it's long and cumbersome and strange. And I say there's a place for that, too.
So the thesis our podcast kind of takes about propaganda, that it's merely just a tool. It can be good. It can be bad. It can be the thing that convinces you to wash your hands and practice social distancing. It can be the thing that convinces you that Fauci created COVID-19, right? It's all about who is using propaganda to convey a message. And in this case, I think, based on the discussion we've had here and my own view of seeing the film, is Kevin Costner is using this as a piece of propaganda to really romanticize that period of American history and say that, like, look, horrible things happened to the Native Americans. But as you can see in this scene, it was only done by horrible people. It wasn't done by, like, everyone else. So I think he's really trying to, after years and years of people that really like Kevin Costner and maybe Yellowstone, of them feeling like the American left is trying to convince them that they are morally decrepit, bad people, this is a movie that's going to kind of make them feel like, actually, you're not bad and America's not bad.
I'd have to disagree with you.
Oh, okay.
I say that the choice of Horizon as the title and what Horizon refers to is one of the great betrayers of the American frontier story. That exploit agricultural kind of experiment failed and resulted in the Dust Bowl. American story of progress was never kind of succeeded. It's been a story of exploitation. We've exploited every resource we have until now we're kind of poised at the end of everything. I think with that choice of title, unless he decides to totally distort history, it cannot help but be an indictment of the American story.
I do think he's going to distort history. I'm not trying to defend.
But then we have a problem. Then we have a real problem. Yeah,
I'd say we do. I mean, one of the things I actually found quite laudable about the program was, in almost every subplot, someone is trying to screw someone over, which is fun. We have the people arriving at the settlement who were clearly sold a bill of goods. We have the guy trying to get out of his plot in Wyoming or wherever under the pretense that there's gold, which he knows there is not. There's the caravanners who seem to be utterly unprepared for some of them, at least, right? Utterly unprepared for the world that they think they're about to inhabit. You have the scalpers who are clearly, you know, going to murder whoever, right, as an excuse of the settlement of this blood debt.
Yeah,
I just think that if the fourth Horizon movie ends historically accurate, the people that loved Horizon 1 will be mad and say that, like, oh, Horizon went woke. Like, I think they'll be frustrated with a more historical thing.
What is this?
You said at the beginning, historicism doesn't matter in Westerns. No, I don't think anybody's going to care. Yeah. Or I don't think that that's going to be a thing that Costner endangers himself with, is being too historically accurate. I can't imagine that.
But the danger is that if he doesn't take that on, then the film will just, you know, exist on a kind of a plateau. It will never advance. It will never change. These people will just be wandering around in the wilderness aimlessly. And I don't think he's ready to make a Cormac McCarthy film. I don't think he can handle that. He's clearly setting this up for the old, you know, as you say, the English family that you reminded me of, that ridiculous woman, you know. you know, because they haven't been killed yet, it means that they are going to kind of survive and that they are going to be improved. Yes. The test of the frontier. This is the Turner thesis, that going into the frontier is like a crucible, the test of fire and all the things that you brought with you, European values, Eastern education, you name it, even the clothing, all of that falls away gradually. You're stripped down to the bare bark of yourself and then rebuilt, shaped by the environment of the frontier. This was the statement of Frederick Jackson Turner to the American Historical Association in Buffalo in 1893 during the Great White City kind of fair. It's a progressive view of American history that explains the importance of democracy in the nation's story. And it has shaped history, never really disappeared until our own time, I think. Now, there are kind of real questions about what about the myth of progress? Where has it led us to? It has led us to climate change and half the nation's on fire or flooded kind of regularly. You know, we've exploited this nation. We've exploited without
a lot of those people don't believe in that. They literally, it cannot penetrate their minds.
They're fucking stupid.
They still believe it.
I don't care. I mean, they're stupid. And they're going down the ship. You know, they pretend to be kind of religious. And what about fucking Noah's Ark? They anticipated, you know, the crisis that was coming and prepared for it. But these fuckers that you're talking about just choose to turn a blind eye to it and be just climate deniers, as they say. Well, they're going down in the deluge. That's how I see it.
We all will.
Yeah.
I would say that Costner is very in that mold. You bring up the idea of the citizen molded. I think that Costner very much believes in this. Is crucially a different kind of citizen, right? Is an elevated citizen. is the ideal American is one that moves out to the frontier, whatever that frontier might be, and remakes themselves and becomes strong. I think this is actually Costner's vision of himself, old and new. Costner believes that his move to Montana to become a 21st century liberal frontiersman, an actor turned rancher, he believes that this has made him, I think.
Yeah, if you look at Yellowstone, I didn't see all of it, but one of the later episodes, he was fighting against an airport being there.
Yes, quite right.
So he's fighting against progress in order to preserve this sort of outdated deal of cattle ranges. And we now all know that raising cattle is a threat to the environment.
Yes.
The belching that cattle do affect the ozone or something like that. It's an out-of-date vision that he represents. It's one that never worked. But we had enough room and space and less population to kind of play it out in. Well, that time is done. I mean, it's done. Kind of replaying these old models, I don't think is helpful. Mm-hmm. We need new models.
I've got to ask what is probably on a few listeners' mind. How did you end up becoming a professor of Western cinema? I mean, you've talked about have seen a lot of these movies in theater houses in London. So what made you so obsessed with these movies about the American West?
Oh, come on. You know, the world hates America, but they love its movies. and as a child growing up in England in the 1950s, the 50s is a big decade for Westerns. That's all that's happening. And in particular, in 1955, Walt Disney came out with The Story of Davy Crockett, which was a gigantic event of the time. I think Newsweek magazine wrote that 1955 or 56 was the year of Davy Crockett. And the price of coonskins went up from like cents a piece to many dollars. It was a bad year for coons. Yeah. You know? And I was 5, 6, 7. I was born in the United States, but grew up in England. So as a child, I had this sense that I was connected to this other place, but didn't have any idea really what it was. And then at that right age, the Walt Disney thing came up. And here's Davy Crockett. Here's this guy in animal skins with a fur hat on his head. And I thought, what the hell is that? You know? What kind of human being is that? And he was just totally attractive. And then a few years later, John Wayne came out with his Alamo film, which hammered that home. And then also in the 50s, Republic Pictures came out with The Last Command, which was an Alamo film emphasizing the role of Jim Bowie with Sterling Hayden. So the 50s not only had a lot to do with Westerns, but had a lot to do with the Alamo and Davy Crockett. And so I was hammered with this attractive creature of nature, something quite different from the English environment, the English scene and historical scene, at least as I perceived it. In later years, reading about this, of course, I was not aware of it as a child, but this is the time of the Cold War. The anti-communist movements working hard in this country. One of the things that they were trying to do, I think, was to put a face on communism so you know what the enemy is. And it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to put a face on communism unless you're dealing with the Chinese communists or something like that. Then you've got people of another color, another race. But if you're not, you're dealing with Russians or even your own people, how do you put a face on it? Well, you can't. But what you can do is put a face on what it is to be an American. And Davy Crockett was the face of Americans for that 1950. It was for me, at any rate. It stuck hard, this sort of mysterious business of being an American but being removed from it was helped by my identity with Davy Crockett. And for some years, I would walk around my community with a Davy Crockett hat on, carrying my rifle, a clear statement to my community who I was. And I guess I never gave it up. I mean, I think the myth of the West as a sense of individual identity with what connected me. And so years later, I found myself here. And of course, I created this course because it stays with me. I think the Western is hugely important as a way in which people identify themselves, who they are. I think that is the importance of the role of history. That's what's so discouraging about kind of living in the near fascist state, is that there is no sense of history because history is discouraged by fascist leaders. They kind of they don't want any memory. They create history every day when you wake up. They restart the deal. No moral dimension to anything. Again, we're just adrift. We're just adrift.
Yeah.
And history is what provides an anchor to ourselves. Now, again, in movies, it's not literal history because they're dramas, as I said, and they get the guns wrong and the religion wrong and they get everything fucking wrong, right? But there's an essence of the past, a sense of the past, an idea of who we are and who we are supposed to be as human beings. That I do think is in there. And I think the good filmmakers have used the genre to work with that kind of idea. Better people to make us better human beings. When the marshal steps out alone into the street in High Noon, abandoned by his community, when he doesn't have to, what higher statement is there than that?
Yeah.
It's all for nothing, Will, says the old sheriff. It's all for nothing. If you're honest, you wind up dying all alone in a dirty street. For what? For a tin star. Well, that's it. That's it. You're either going to stand up for that tin star or you're not. The Western introduces a kind of a sense of moral high ground.
That's quite right. That's interesting. There's no sheriffs in this film.
Well, Costner did. He defends that prostitute and kills that bad guy. He's Shane. He didn't want to do that particularly, but he can't help himself.
But there's no explicit lawman, which is interesting. Yeah. I didn't even notice that.
And also, do you notice how many bullets it takes to kill people?
I actually quite like that.
Whether that was related to the firearms.
In terms of realism, modern firearms are not substantially different in their ability to... if you're shot, you do not die right away. If you're shot in the head, you do not die right away. Something I've gone at lengths to tell people and nobody seems to believe me because nobody has any. I mean, I don't have personal background, but I've known quite a few people who have, and I've seen too many videos to tell you that. It's quite nice to see that bit of realism in a Western where it is only used for dramatic effect selectively and is so oftentimes a shot from the hip and a man falls in the street dead into the dust, you know, ridiculous, but highly effective for the mythology of the gunslinger and of outlaw justice and the quickness with which the individual can dispense with evil, right? All those things are in Quick Death, which is
right.
Unfortunately, anyway, rarely the case.
It did stand out that a lot of guns were fired, a lot of shots were fired, rather.
Yeah.
But anyway, he is the moral man. I don't like his hat, but I think hats are important. I think the greatest Western hat was probably John Wayne's crumpled cavalry hat, which is shaped by the paintings of Frederick Remington again, who kind of wrote endlessly about how wonderful the creased hats were of the cavalrymen that he watch. And Wayne's hat, I actually got to see that hat for real, one-to-one, when I went to interview Michael Wayne many years ago. He had a room filled with stuff in there, and the number one hat, as they called it, the number one hat was there on a little stand, and it was really beat up because he had loaned it to one of the Rat Pack, Sammy Davis Jr. They made a Western years ago, Sergeants 3 or something like that.
Good? I haven't seen it.
So Sammy, neither have I, but Sammy Davis wore that hat, Wayne's hat, And in the film, they kind of they beat it up and, you know, so it was unwearable after that. But that was a great hat that I think worked with Wayne at any rate. Now, like Clint Eastwood, in his Italian westerns, I think he's wearing his Rowdy Yates hat. I think he carries that with him. His TV.
Is it the same one?
I'm wondering. It looks like it. But after that, when he starts making westerns after that on his own, he obviously wants to break out, so he needs a new hat. And it seems to me he never, ever finds a hat that really works. They just kind of sit on his head, but they're not really connected to him. That's my take. And Costner, in this one, he's wearing what I call an Indian reservation hat. It's an unblocked hat. You know, it's just got the uncreased crown and the flat brim. It's just the way it comes out of the manufacturer, not being shaped.
Yeah,
it's noticeable, and I felt I needed to comment on it.
I think the small things matter. I mean, when you watch Leone, the small things are what really...
You see, he gets all the stuff right, I think.
At least as far as his own vision of flavor.
I'm not talking about historically. Yeah.
Everything's him.
It
Everything's
is.
His impression.
Because he's in touch with all that stuff. Because what I would call the outer elements of the genre, all the stuff, horses, equipment, hats, people, landscape, all the things that light bounce off or that sound picks up, you know, because it is a film medium. He's totally in touch with that. Nothing goes by. And that's why his films are so fresh, because he does spend so much attention on all of that. And some of that's there in Costner's film as well. Some of that, but...
The wardrobe's very good, I'd say. Women should be wearing bonnets. Their hair should always be up. But the wardrobes are quite good. The locations are phenomenal. I mean, he shoots in places that are beautiful. They're gorgeous. The escape through the beechwood forest in autumn, right, with yellow leaves. I mean, it's the Japanese cherry, but it's the American version of the cherry blossom forest, right? It's phenomenal. Great.
No, you're absolutely right. That's and a celebration of the land is not out of place in the Western, because this is the place where it's going to happen. If you're buying into that old myth, this embrace of nature is going to allow our own natures to kind of blossom. That's the game. And that's why the Indians are important, because they are nature in this story. You know, if you're, that's the old white myth. The problem is we're not comfortable with the old white myth any longer. We feel like we have to have the Indian myth too, but we don't understand that myth. So we fuck it up. You know, like I said, we have these over reverential kind of scenes where the camera doesn't move. Everything stops dead. It's and when we do have a great Indian moment, like the guy being killed by other Indians, it's based on a Frederick Remington vision, not on an Indian vision, you see? And how do we escape? How do we escape our vision when dealing with the Indians? That's a tough, tough business. That's not simple. And how to do that, I don't know. I have filmed Indians many years ago in Mexico, a tribe, the Lacandon Maya, who were still non-Christianized, living in the forest and spending time with them. So I got to be with them as people, not as mythic figures. I found they had a huge sense of humor and were constantly trying to kind of make fun of you and see how you'd react, see if they could get, you know, it's like, you know, they were people, kind of interesting and with depth, but just different. Their depth was different from ours because they live in a fucking rainforest. I mean, their kind of receptors are geared to that. So Costner has that to deal with. How does he deal with that? And at the moment, I don't see it. I don't see it working. Again, we'll give him time. But you know, I think he did a better job in Dances with Wolves. They had real humor. They were funny.
Yes.
He did tap into that there. That lovely scene where they come to visit him and he's providing coffee. There's sugar to go in it. One of the Indians, the brutish one, is putting sugar into his friend's coffee and it's like, too much, stop it. It's funny, which means that they're human. OK, that cognitive sense, you know, it requires a high cognitive sense to recognize humor. It just does. So it's making them human in Dances with Wolves. I haven't seen it in this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, Costner's a stoic, and I think he sees stoicism as a high virtue.
Yeah, you have to watch out because it looks like solemnity and it's boorish.
Brian Huberman is a professor of film and film production at Rice University and a documentarian. Professor Huberman, thank you so much for joining us on this discussion of Kevin Costner's meandering film.
Okay, well, nice chatting.
I had an idea.
Wow, that was fun.
Yeah. Wasn't that great, gang? Hey, send us an email at propagandospod@gmail.com. Let's keep the conversation going. Do you have something you want to say to Propagandos? Send us an email and we'll read it on the show. Slurs will get bleeped. So go off.
Are you an old guy that has tenure that's willing to talk to us for 2 hours? You can be on the motherfucking show, dog.
Are you an old guy who's pissed off about what Professor Huberman had to say about America as a fascist state? Let us know, and we'll tell him.
Nah, we love Professor Huberman. He's great.
Yeah, really, really hope to have him back. If y'all couldn't tell, I was blown away by the discussion, so... Kudos to Professor Huberman and kudos to you, the listeners, for sticking with us after 18 glorious episodes. We'll see you soon. And remember, keep your eyes on the stars, listeners.
That's such a shitty fucking tagline, dude.